housekeeping item. Before we begin, I have a few housekeeping items I want to discuss briefly. We have about 40 people registered for this call, maybe more. In order to eliminate background noise, everybody's phone has been automatically set to mute. When you have a question during the Q&A period, just hit *6 to unmute your phone. After you ask your question, please mute your phone again by hitting *6 to keep the background noise to a minimum. I plan to speak for about 20 minutes or so. At that time, we'll open up the floor to questions, and we should have plenty of time to have a conversation. We will close promptly at 1 p.m. So let's get started. The presentation today will focus on two main issues: the ways children are exposed to toxic environmental chemicals and why children are more vulnerable to these environmental chemicals. So why do we focus on children? Primarily because regulations and laws are inadequate to protect children from environmental chemicals. Regulations are primarily based upon an adult's body, weight, and behaviors, not a children's body, weight, and behaviors. For example, a doctor wouldn't give a child the same amount of aspirin as an adult would take. Environmental chemical exposure should be no different. They need to be child protective. Another important factor is that children are more vulnerable to environmental chemicals than adults. And this is because children are not little adults. Infants and children are different from adults. They are exposed more often to environmental threats than adults, and they are more susceptible to environmental disease than adults. So let's look at some of these differences. Children move through several stages of rapid growth and development, from infancy through adolescence. During this period, children are growing and adding new tissue more rapidly than in any other period of their lives. From conception to age 7, growth is most rapid. The ensuing years through adolescence bring continued growth as crucial systems such as the reproductive mature. Insulation of brain fiber, nerve fibers, is not complete until adolescence. Similarly, air sacs in the lungs where oxygen enters the bloodstream increase in number until adolescence. Because these tissues and organ systems are still developing and mature at different rates, children are susceptible to environmental chemicals over an extended period of time. During these critical years, the structures and vital connections develop. Body systems are not suited to repair damage caused by toxic chemicals. Thus, if a neurotoxin assaults cells in the brain, immune system, or reproductive organs, or if endocrine disruption diverts development, resulting dysfunction will likely be permanent and irreversible. Depending on the organ damage, consequences can include lowered intelligence, immune dysfunction, or reproductive impairment. Furthermore, because a child's organ systems are still developing, they absorb, metabolize, detoxify, and excrete poisons differently than adults. In some instances, children are actually better able to deal with environmental chemicals. More commonly, though, they are less able and thus much more vulnerable. For example, children absorb about 50% of the lead to which they expose, while adults absorb only 10 to 15%. Their less developed immune system is more susceptible to bacteria such as strep, to ear infections, to viruses such as flu, and to chemical toxins. Children also eat more food, drink more fluids, and breathe more air per pound of body weight than adults. Children aged 1 to 5 eat 3 to 4 times more per pound of body weight than the average adult. Infants and children drink more water on a body weight basis and take in more air. Differences in body proportions between children and adults mean children have proportionally more skin exposure as well. Another issue is that children behave like children. Normal activities heighten children's vulnerability to environmental threats. Their natural curiosity, tendency to explore, and inclination to place their hands in their mouth often opens them to health risks adults readily avoid. Young children crawl and play on the ground or floor and play outside. These natural tendencies expose them to contaminated dust and soil, pesticide residue, chemicals used to disinfect or clean, garden weed killers, fertilizers, and other potentially hazardous substances. Air pollution impacts children more because they are frequently outdoors and are physically active. Thus, they breathe pollutants more deeply and directly into their lungs. And as I mentioned, their natural curiosity leads them to explore. And in some situations, this could expose them to environmental hazards. For example, they may enter fenced-off areas of polluted creeks and streams that adults wouldn't go into. Children also have more time to develop disease. Children's longer remaining lifespan provides more time for environmentally-induced diseases to develop. Exposure to carcinogens as a child, as opposed to an adult, is a particular concern since cancer can take decades to develop. For all of these reasons, children are more exposed and are more vulnerable to environmental threats than adults. So now let's talk about some of the adverse health effects that we're seeing in children. It has become quite clear in the past 10 years or so that children are suffering a wide range of health problems. While researchers do not understand all of the interactions between chemical exposure and growing children, the rising rate of childhood disease is indisputable. Asthma afflicts over 7 million U.S. children and is the leading cause of school absenteeism, the third leading cause of hospital admission among children. There is an estimated 4.2 million lost school days in children with asthma flare-ups during the previous year. Triggers for asthma in children include allergens and irritants. Allergens include pollen, mold, spores, animal dander, dust mites, cockroach parts, rodent urine, and certain foods. Common indoor irritants include strong odors and vapors found in household cleaning products, cooking fumes, paint, pesticides, cigarette smoke, off-gassing from building materials and carpets, and nitrogen oxides from unvented gas appliances and wood-burning fireplaces. Outdoor irritants include ozone, such as smog, sulfur dioxide from coal burning, carbon monoxide from combustion, nitrogen oxides from industrial processes and automobile emissions, lead and particulate matter. Sulfur dioxide and ozone cause constriction and inflammation of air passages and interact with nitrogen oxides to cause adverse health effects on the respiratory system. Fine particulates, smoke, soot, and dust particles of 2.5 microns or less in diameter pose a greater health concern than larger particles because they are small enough to be inhaled deep into the lungs. Let's look at cancer now. Cancer is the number one disease-related cause of death in children. Approximately 10,350 new cases of cancer are expected to occur in children aged 0 to 15 this year. The American Cancer Society estimates that 1,250 children under the age of 15 will die of cancer this year. From 1975 to 2010, the overall incidence of childhood cancers in the U.S. increased by an average of 0.6% per year for children ages 0 to 19. That's an increase of 21% over the 35-year period. Specifically, the incidence of cancer rates increased for four cancer types in children: acute lymphoid leukemia, acute myeloid leukemia, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and testicular cancer. The most common cancer in children ages 0 to 14 is acute lymphocytic leukemia, making up 20% of the total cancers in children. The second most common cancer type is brain and central nervous system cancer, which makes up 8% of the total. Childhood learning disabilities, hyperactive behavior, and the inability to maintain attention have also soared nationwide. The number of children in special ed programs increased from 1.8% in 1976 to 12.9% in 2012. Conservative estimates are that attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, affects 5% of all school-age children, though some researchers suggest a much higher rate, one near 17%. Autism is also skyrocketing. In California, one study in childhood autism found an increase of 634% between 1987 and 2002. Now, many children have allergies and have developed chemical sensitivities. This is mostly the result of indoor pollution that can cause or aggravate allergies and chemical sensitivities. Many children have allergic reactions to pests, dust, pollen, and other common natural and man-made substances. Some children are also sensitive to one or more chemical substances. It is estimated that 30% of the population is sensitive to at least one substance, such as perfume. About 15% of people are sensitive to more than one substance, and while 4 to 6% have disabling chemical sensitivities, referred to as multiple chemical sensitivities, or MCS. People with MCS experience extreme physical reactions to levels of chemicals that the average person would not react to. Chemical sensitivities can be caused by a single severe chemical exposure or by many exposures over an extended time period. It's not clear how many children are affected by chemical sensitivities. If the prevalence of this condition is the same for children as it is for adults, then millions are affected. Reducing exposures to chemicals and chemical products and improving the quality of indoor air will improve conditions for children with allergies and chemical sensitivities and help prevent children from getting these conditions. Another concern is hormone disruption. Some substances can cause subtle hormone effects on the developing fetus or young infants that can alter a child's functional capacities. These hormone-disrupting chemicals interfere with normal hormone functions in the body and can affect the normal growth and development of a child. For example, a hormone-disrupting substance can send the wrong message about thyroid levels in the brain, which are critical to normal neurological development. Lower thyroid levels in the brain can cause permanent brain damage that can result in mental retardation, hearing loss, speech problems, impaired learning and memory, hyperactivity, and attention deficit disorder. Typical hormone-disrupting chemicals include substances such as PCBs, dioxins, arsenic, bisphenol A, cadmium, lead, mercury, phthalates, and styrene. These increases in disease and disability critically impact the present and future of our nation. Making our children sick or unable to develop their full intellectual potential could devastate future generations, the economy, and everyone's quality of life. Now, the next question I want to address is, how are children exposed to toxic chemicals? There are four primary routes of exposure, four ways that children are exposed. The first is in utero, or via transplacental, toxic chemicals that enter the fetus through the placenta before birth. Then we have ingestion. Toxic chemicals enter the gastrointestinal tract, through the stomach, through eating, drinking, breastfeeding, or hand-to-mouth behavior. Breathing is the third one. Toxic chemicals enter the respiratory tract or through the lungs by inhalation. And then there's skin or dermal contact. The child touches a toxic substance or a surface with a residue of a toxic substance. And you either have direct exposure and absorption through the skin or through hand-to-mouth activity. Where do some of these chemicals, environmental chemicals, come from? Since 1950, more than 80,000 chemicals have been created and are in use in the United States. These chemicals eventually end up in the environment, either as a product or as a waste. Consequently, children are exposed to many of these chemicals in the air they breathe, the water they drink, and the food they eat. Industrial plants like oil refineries, plastic manufacturers, coal-fired power plants, chemical, garbage, and medical waste incinerators all release chemicals into the air. Garbage and medical waste incinerators, for example, burn huge amounts of plastics and other packaging waste. They also burn hazardous and toxic waste that isn't supposed to be in the mix. These incinerators release many chemicals into the air through their smokestacks, including a chemical called dioxin, the most toxic chemical known to man. Children do not need to live under a smokestack to be exposed. They can live thousands of miles away. For example, scientists have tracked the movement of airborne dioxin from Louisiana's industrial incinerator smokestack, traveling as far north as the Great Lakes, thousands of miles away. Dioxin and other airborne chemicals are easily carried by wind currents. Indoor air pollution is another source of chemical exposure. New carpets, paint, and other renovations can cause chemicals to vaporize into the air. The new carpet smell that you may be familiar with is a mixture of chemical vapors, glues, and gases. Pesticides are another source of exposure. Pesticides are widely used in schools, daycare centers, public buildings, and parks. Pesticides are poisons, which is why they kill pests. When pesticides are applied, some of the chemical becomes airborne, especially when they're sprayed, exposing people, including children, in the area. But even after the application is complete, the chemicals remain on the surface of the classroom floor, the carpet, or the grass of a playground or park for a long time. Children come in contact with these pesticide residues while playing, participating in school activities. Schools routinely use pesticides with little or no warning to parents. An estimated 74% of American households use some type of pesticide. Herbicides are similar. They are chemicals which are applied to lawns, parks, and school grounds without public notification in most communities. When you see a lawn care truck in your neighborhood or at the parks, groundskeepers using a spray, they're usually applying pesticides, herbicides, or chemical fertilizers on the ground. Children playing soccer, falling and rolling in the grass can become exposed to these dangerous chemicals. The chemicals remain long after they are applied. Drinking water can also carry chemicals, and certainly the crisis in Flint has made this clear to everybody nationwide. Urban areas usually have a water treatment plant that tests and treats the drinking water supply. However, most of the routine chemicals that are tested by these systems are not chemicals or very limited chemicals. The most focus is more on bacteria. Private wells in rural areas are not part of the public testing system, so it's up to the user, to you, the owner of the well, to test for chemicals yourself. There have been several clusters of childhood cancer in both urban and rural communities due to chemical contamination in drinking water. And then, of course, you have, again, what happens in Flint, where you have lead exposures and all the ramification of those exposures that will be affecting children there for years. Finally, the food we eat can carry with it many different types of chemicals. Pesticide residues are widespread in the U.S. food supply. Data from the Food and Drug Administration for the past 9 years show that between 33 and 39% of the food supply in any given year contains detectable pesticide residues. Concerned about contaminated food and children's health, the National Academy of Sciences looked at chemical residues in a one-year-old's top 10 favorite foods. These foods are apple juice, grape juice, oats, milk, apples, orange juice, pears, wheat, and peaches. On a body weight basis, young children consume these foods at levels from 3 to 21 times greater than the average adult. The FDA found pesticides in 50% of the samples of these foods. Meat, fish, and dairy also contain pesticides and other chemicals which collect in the fatty tissue of animals and fish. When children drink milk, eat fish, cheese, or a hamburger, they are ingesting chemicals that have been stored in the animal's fat. The list of chemicals in our food, water, and air can be a little overwhelming, but once we understand how chemicals get into the children's food supply, water, and environment, we can take steps to stop this. The average consumer and parent usually have no idea which foods or products they should buy, because the unwanted chemicals are not listed, and this is a problem that needs to be addressed. We should also be concerned not only about the child's environment after birth, but also with prenatal exposure. Children receive their first exposures to chemicals while in the mother's womb. When a child is developing during pregnancy, the mother's body mobilizes fat to nourish the child. Stored chemicals like dioxins transfer to the mother's fat to nourish the developing baby. Dioxin is one of several chemicals that can cross the placenta and interfere with development of a baby, damaging organs and body systems. For example, interference with the immune system can result in the child developing allergies. Interference with the brain can result in learning disabilities. Interference with the nervous system can result in hyperactivity and attention deficit disorder. Interference with the reproductive organs can result in low sperm count, early puberty in girls, and reduction of the size of male organs, and other problems, including birth defects and low birth weight babies. Eliminating environmental chemicals may seem too big, too much for us to be able to accomplish, but we can take steps that can affect this outcome. We need to begin by eliminating many of the chemicals from our environment, which can be done without economic loss or even sacrificing our lifestyle. By eliminating the most toxic chemicals from our environment, we will significantly reduce our children's risk of disease and other health problems from environmental chemicals. Remember that what our children are exposed to and are storing in their bodies today will be passed on to their children, our grandchildren, in the future. So in summary and conclusion, there are many ways in which our children are exposed to environmental chemicals each and every day. Children are more vulnerable to chemicals than adults, and growing evidence can be seen in today's health statistics about increases in childhood disease. There are steps each of us can take to protect our children. We can begin by taking simple steps by asking our schools, daycare centers, parks, and recreational centers about their use of chemicals. We can become community detectives and look more closely at what chemicals are released in our community. Finally, we can be responsible consumers and parents by not buying and using chemicals in and around our home. So I want to thank you for your time. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have, and we can open now the floor to a conversation. As a reminder, before you ask your question, hit *6 and that will unmute your line. And then ideally, if you would, after you ask your question, hit *6 again so that we keep the background noise to a minimum. So, the floor is yours. Remember to hit *6 to unmute your line.
I have a question. How many children need to be affected by something for them to actually start a study? We
Identify yourself briefly.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Susie Quinn from Torch, Ohio.
Great, thanks.
We know at least three different families who their children have to take growth hormones. Can that be attributed to some of the chemical exposure that you spoke about?
I'm not sure I understand. They're taking these growth hormones because of other aspects of their health. That's not right. Susie, could you come back on, please? I'm sorry.
Because they were taking the growth hormones because they were not developing and growing. Their growth was stunted.
Yes. Now I understand you. Yes, it's possible that prior exposure to toxic chemicals when they were young, or perhaps even when they were in the mom's womb, they could have been exposed to endocrine disrupting chemicals or other substances which would have affected their development, and result being that now that they're older, their doctors are prescribing growth hormones to help adopt and adapt to their conditions. Other questions?
Hello?
Yeah.
Hi.
Just identify yourself briefly, please.
Deborah Gindella from Suffern, New York.
Uh-huh.
I'm having trouble finding places to go to get both my blood tested and my water tested for many of the chemicals that you mentioned. Do you have any answer to that?
The question of trying to find a place to do blood testing is much tougher. There are a few labs around the country that do this, but the real question becomes, how do you interpret your results? There have been a few studies done by the Center for Disease Control. There's something called the NHANES study that has done some testing of different parts of people, of chemicals in people's blood from different parts of the country. But they have a very limited number of substances that they've looked at, so that you can only learn so much from that. When you go to
I think the problem is that I just want to get it measured. I'll know what to do with it after I know what I have.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know there's a lab in Texas. I would have to get some contact information to you and get that information to you after the call. I don't have that information available to me, but I know there is a lab in Texas that will do blood testing.
All right.
As far as
up with you with an email, but I have the same problem with the water because I have my own well.
Mm-hmm. Water testing is much different. There are many more labs that will do that around the country. Often I would suggest that you don't go to a lab in New York to do this testing, primarily because, and that's where you're from, I think, right?
Right, but I'm moving to New Jersey.
Okay. So, I mean, it's good to have the testing done in a lab that's out of the state that you live in. At least that's been my experience. Because often these labs use the state or as a client at some point in time, or that often they do a lot of work with consultants who are doing work for ultimately the state or even the companies that are often the responsible parties for a lot of the contamination. So there's often conflicts, and sometimes that can affect the results you get or the advice that you get in terms of the help you might get in trying to get a good test taken. It's very important when you take a water sample that you do it properly, especially if you're looking for volatile organic chemicals in your water, chemicals like benzene or toluene. And that becomes an important question to ask yourself and to think through, which is what is it that you want to test for? There are over 120 priority pollutants. That is a common group of substances that are often tested. It's not what the government tests in drinking water in these public water supplies. I mean, they typically look just for heavy metals and a few other groups of compounds like trihalomethanes. But when you're doing your own testing at your well, it's an important question to try to sort through what to look for. And that's something I'd be happy to talk with you in more detail one-on-one. So I think I could be off, you know, that might be a good thing to do is to send us an email or to, you know, at chj.org, chj@chj.org, and I'll be happy to get back to you and we can have a more in-depth conversation about the place you can do testing for chemicals in your blood and what to look for chemicals in your water. And I also provide you some details about how to, what to look, where to send those tests to be analyzed. Other questions, comments?
Can you hear me?
Yes. Just brief identification, please.
My name is. Am I the only one on here speaking now? I'm in Western Pennsylvania, and I know that there was some congressional movement on toxic chemicals and standards. Do you know if that passed or where we are with getting any kind of thing? I know it's been a good dozen years of attempting to get some protection.
Yes, that law was recently passed in Congress. I'm not sure it is. I don't believe. Excuse me. I forget exactly what it's called. Honestly, the Toxic Prevention Act or something like that. But it was passed in Congress about 2 weeks ago. I don't believe the president has signed the bill yet, but it's gotten congressional support on both sides of the House and the Senate, so it is likely to be passed and signed by the President.
Anyone seen that or reviewed it? Is it something that's actually a step forward or just a pretend?
I think it's a step forward in some ways and a step backwards and sideways in other ways. There's mixed support in the environmental community. The group that you want to contact that's been following this and has lots of stuff on their website about it is called Safer Chemicals, Healthy Families. If you go to their website, they will have lots of information. That group is a coalition of organizations. CHEJ is a participant with that group on a lot of their campaigns, including this one about the chemical policy reform. But if you go to their website, they will have lots of details about what's good about the bill, what's bad about it, what they like about it, what they're supporting and what they're not.
Thank you.
Sure. Other thoughts, questions? Let me just add one thing that has struck me quite remarkably with regard to blood levels due to lead, and this has come out of the situation in Flint again. You know, some of the levels of lead in the blood of the children there in the city are still quite high. People are continuing to struggle with the water that's being provided to the public there. Levels of lead are still remarkably high in some parts of the community. The way EPA determines whether a municipality like Flint passes or its lead standard is by a statistical test. Only 90% of the population, 90% of the samples that are taken, have to meet the action levels for lead. So as much as 10% of the population or the people getting lead can have levels well above that. And so it's really a misjustice to define having a city's water declared safe to drink by only having 90% of the values on average below the action level of 15 parts per billion. Other thoughts, questions?
Hi, this is Susie Quinn again. You mentioned about laboratories that do the blood testing.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have those available on a website? And is there a list of the different chemicals that they can test your blood for?
No, we don't have any kind of list like that. We've never tried to put something like that together because we have no way of evaluating these labs. So if we put a list together, it would be a form of an endorsement and a recommendation. So without being able to really evaluate how good and the quality of these labs, we don't put together lists. I do know of a couple of labs, and as I mentioned to the other lady, that we could, you know, I'd be happy to share that with you offline, not as a recommendation, but just as a lab I know that does this work.
Okay.
They do limited testing, mostly for volatile organic chemicals. And from what they have done in the past, and honestly, I don't even know if they still do this because I haven't looked recently, but what they often will send you to help you interpret the results is a chart that says, of the people that we have tested in the past, these are the ranges of levels for these chemicals that we've seen. So you've got pretty much a self-selected group of folks who go to this lab primarily because they think they've been exposed to chemicals. And so the levels that they are seeing and reporting in their range would be of, you know, people who have a belief that they've been exposed to chemicals. So it's a bit of a biased group, but it's something to compare it to. The more complicated question is, as I mentioned to the other caller, is like, how do you interpret these results? There is no standards for what the numbers mean. I mean, on a simplistic level, nobody should have these chemicals in their blood. So having any is an indictment of exposure. But what do you do about that? You know, there's limited steps that one can take to eliminate chemicals from your body or to address the exposures you've had, but it's a form of information, it's a form of knowledge, and you know, if it's something you can afford to do, it can, you know, it gives you information.
That was going to be my next question, is what kind of cost a person would be looking at if they went to one of these labs to have their blood tested?
That I don't know. I've never asked that question, so I don't know what it costs. I'm sure it's not cheap, depending on what you're looking for. Often these labs will do a set type of test, looking for a set group of compounds. So for that, it's usually a standard price. If you're looking to have a more broad analysis done of chemicals that could be in your body, that I'm sure would cost a lot more.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you very much. And thanks for your lecture today.
Yep. we have other questions, comments? We still have some more time, so don't be shy.
Hello?
Yes.
The woman from New York is back.
Okay.
You may or may not know the answer to this. Since I'm straddling two states right now, I've noticed that there are a lot of prohibitions about getting tests done, and I forget which state it's in because... So if I were to ask you about that...
I don't know, went into a dead zone or something. I didn't hear your comment there.
Okay. Should I start over? In the past, I've had trouble getting tested depending on what state I lived in.
Okay. Why would you have trouble? I'm not sure I understand.
Because you have to have a doctor first before you can go to the lab.
I'm not sure that's always the case.
Okay, good.
I think it's been my experience that some of these labs now will work directly with you to provide you with you know, you'll probably need a doctor to take your blood, so it's not like you can do this in isolation of a physician at all. So I think you'll need to go someplace to have your blood taken, and then you would have to properly package it and prepare it for shipping to the lab. But usually the lab would go through that with you as to how to do that.
Great.
So I think you can find a way to do that. That's done in a way that gives you a good, valid result. Okay, do we have any other calls or comments, questions?
Hi, Stephen. This is Sharon from Friends of Lackawanna.
Hi.
How are you? I was wondering if you could go over some toxins that are found in municipal landfills and maybe discuss the pathways of exposure.
Sure. In a landfill, you really have an entire mixed bag. I mentioned earlier a group of chemicals called the priority pollutants. They were generated as a list of chemicals for contaminated drinking water. But you'd find all 128 of those chemicals very likely in a landfill. And they would include volatile organic chemicals like chloroform or benzene or trichloroethylene, methyl ethyl ketone. They would include heavy metals, mercury, lead, cadmium, chromium. They would include complicated chemicals like polyaromatic hydrocarbons, PAHs, and a variety of PCBs, and a host of other semi-volatile chemicals as well. So the primary means by which these chemicals would leave the landfill would be pretty varied. You would have direct evaporation of volatile compounds, especially in hot weather, from wherever it's placed in the ground or while it's being delivered via trucks or when it's offloaded from the trucks into piles that are then moved by front-end loaders or other bulldozers into the landfill. So you have direct volatilization. You would have what are called fugitive emissions, which is direct volatilization, but from sort of the transport and the piles. So, but it's essentially the same thing. You would also have runoff from leachate or rainwater. Leachate can be generated. Leachate is just simply a mixture of liquid and chemicals. Sometimes those liquids and that moisture is generated in the garbage waste, household waste, that's mixed in with all that's in that's coming to the landfill. And then you have rainfall. So when water or the piles of trash sit on prior to being actually placed in the ground or delivery in trucks sometimes. Sometimes these vehicles that deliver it are not covered or covered only partially so water can get in. So when you have that mixture, you have more leachate generated, and when that leachate can run off from the surface, both in those piles prior to placement in the ground and through the ground itself. Even if these cells that they're placing the garbage in are sealed with either plastic liners or, in some cases, clay. Because these and this wouldn't be something that would be leaching out immediately or within the short term, but it would be something that would be long-term leakage. There is no clay that can hold chemicals with time, and some of the chemicals that are placed in landfills and end up mixing in this leachate can deteriorate clay. It can also deteriorate the plastic, the PVC-type liners that are often used in landfills. So it's just a matter of time. All landfills will leak, so you'll get groundwater contamination eventually. You can also have another route of exposure potentially would be direct contact. Not as likely, but it's still something that's a potential possibility where you would have children or kids. I mean, people have told me stories of kids who ride motorcycles or go and play in areas that were once landfills and not operating landfills current, but down the road when they close the landfill and they take away the fencing and the companies that are responsible walk away and go away. So that's another potential exposure. Another potential exposure are animals. Animals that could track onto a landfill area, drink leachate water, become contaminated or exposed to chemicals in a variety of different ways. And then people can hunt those animals. I mean, not so much a problem perhaps in Pennsylvania where you are, but maybe in more rural areas where hunting is quite common and where deer and other animals that could end up on a landfill site. And again, this would be largely closed landfills, not necessarily operating landfills, although there's potential for that as well. So let me think. I think that's about it in terms of routes of exposure. You have the air routes, the groundwater routes, and of course the groundwater can intercept and affect drinking water where people are down gradient and downstream from the entrance of those contaminants, the groundwater from the leachate. Oh, there's another possibility as well, which is a combination of the groundwater and the air, because there is a process known as vapor intrusion. And what this is that volatile chemicals, the benzenes, the xylenes, the toluenes, and whatnot, that are present in the leachate, in the liquid contaminant from the landfills, they can evaporate out of the liquid in the groundwater and travel through soil. And the most common way this happens around landfills is with methane gas. That's the dominant gas generated by landfills, and so that will be the primary gas that's evaporating and what people are most familiar with, because this methane can travel laterally through the soil once it's left the groundwater and enter basements of a home and can build up and concentrate and explode. If somebody were to walk into a room that's got high levels of methane and light a cigarette or light a burner or something else. So there are quite a few examples. EPA at one point had a list of some 29 explosions that had occurred in different buildings near household garbage landfills. And that's just looking at the methane risk, not looking at the toxic chemical risk. Because at the time that EPA did that analysis, I don't think they even recognized vapor intrusion as a route of exposure for toxic chemicals. Now it's well understood and well considered a primary threat to homes, and particularly the basements of homes, but homes built near landfills. I mean, there's quite a few examples of situations where people have contacted us who have private homes that are built near, a couple of miles, as far away as a mile or two from a landfill, and they're having chemicals evaporating from groundwater moving from the landfill towards their home, but they have vapor intrusion coming into their house, and they have levels of all kinds of toxic chemicals in their home. One group in Montana, outside of Montana, actually walked away from their house because they were uncomfortable living in this house with these chemicals, which, of course, the state said to them, oh, there's nothing to be concerned about. These are all the levels of chemicals in your home are all acceptable by their standards. It wasn't acceptable by my standards, and it wasn't acceptable by the standards these individuals are willing to accept. But it is a problem. I think that covers it for roots of exposure. Yeah?
Hi, this is Pia Miller with Alaska Community Action on Toxics, and first, thank you for your very helpful presentation and interesting discussion here. I just have a question and wondered if you might address in some more detail about the multi-generational effects of certain toxic chemicals and, you know, how toxic chemicals might affect maybe three generations down and how that works.
Okay, that's a great question. I think this is one of those areas of study in terms of health impact of exposure to chemicals that we're still learning a great deal. But with many chemicals, the damage to the reproductive system can occur in ways that the impacts are passed on from generation to generation. Damage to a person's, a woman's eggs or a man's sperm can actually affect future generations as they're passed on genetically to their offspring and to their children. At Love Canal, for example, we looked at, or not we, but the state of New York looked at children who were born to parents who were exposed at Love Canal. And they had some of the same rates of reproductive disorders and birth defects as their parents did who were born at Love Canal. And this was really a remarkable finding. I mean, I think when this came out, it was a big surprise because there really was belief, there wasn't certainty that, you know, you could pass this these exposures on to future generations who were not exposed directly to the chemicals. And so, but we're learning more and more about this. And this is something that genetically it is being passed on. And when some of this damage, particularly with these endocrine disrupting chemicals, it is causing multi-generational effects. And the reproductive outcomes are some of the most common that we're looking at and learning more about all the time. It's kind of scary too when you think about it, because you know you can bring your kids up to try to protect them in all kinds of ways, but sometimes they're being exposed through your exposures, through the parents' exposures. Which, of course, everyone tries to minimize, but sometimes you're not aware of these things. And I think a lot of the population is just learning about the sea of chemicals that we live in, and I think most people just don't understand that when you buy a toy at Toys R Us or at Walmart or wherever, that often these toys are made with chemicals that pose risks because they're outgassing. And children who are going to play with these toys are going to have the chemical exposure. I think once people are educated and understand this, they're backing away from that and walking away from those kinds of toys. But they have to know first. Other questions? We still have a few more minutes. Still have, if people want to make a comment, that's great too.
Hello, Dr. Lester?
Yes?
Hi, this is Rhonda Hamilton from
the Mayor Buzzard Point Residential Community. You came out a couple of weeks to our community.
Yes, how are you doing?
With Empower. I'm doing fine. I just wanted to thank you so much for your lecture. I learned a great deal this afternoon by listening to it. I don't have an actual question at this moment, but I just wanted to make that comment, and thank you so much again.
I appreciate that. Thank you. Okay, anybody else? If not, we'll wrap up.
Yeah, hi, this is Ron Saff, a physician in Tallahassee, Florida. There's a lot of leaded service lines that go into homes. People have difficulty checking lead levels. It's, getting the taking the lead level, taking the water and getting the lead measured is difficult for many people. They can't afford it. Do you recommend using any routine aerators or anything to catch the lead coming out of tap water sinks?
That's an interesting question. The idea of aerators do capture lead. I think it is a helpful step. Another step to reduce lead exposures in your water would be to run your tap for a few minutes before drinking any water from it. And a third step is to run your water at high speed, at high flow. That will all help to sort of flush any lead that kind of settles in the water line, particularly overnight or for a period that the water hasn't been run. So all of those are things that can reduce the lead in your water that you're drinking. These happen to be almost all recommendations that EPA used to give to people taking water samples to determine the lead level in your water. And it's somewhat of an outrage, actually, when that's been the protocol for EPA and its recommendations to water samplers for years, because those steps all minimize the level of lead in your water and would reduce the actual lead if you didn't do those things, and give you a false sense of the lead in your water is lower than it might actually be. Just as a result of Flint and Mark Edwards and others who have been kind of raising these issues about the procedures for how you test the lead in water, EPA reacted to all of that and has come out with new guidelines that they released at the end of February, a few months ago, that do not call for those kinds of procedures for measuring lead in water, because all of those things that I mentioned would reduce the levels of lead. And so it's good to see that that has changed at the EPA level, and this memo was supposedly sent to water districts, to all their water directors in all their regions, and to other water testing and water treatment companies around the country. But even since then, we've come across a couple of situations, and we're not the biggest group in the world to have come across two situations where the state agencies were saying, no, we can't, we found this lead in the water, but we didn't test properly. And so we have to go back and test properly, and their proper test procedures are to do these things, to run the water for 5 minutes before sampling, to remove the aerator. And to do a few other things that, to test at low flow, or at high flow, excuse me. And so so the memo hasn't gotten to all the water companies that are testing lead, and so I think that's an important question to ask if you're looking to have lead tested, or to ask your water company that tests for lead quarterly for, not necessarily every home, but for the main water supply that's being delivered, used to deliver water to your home.
Thank you.
Okay, any last questions, last thoughts? Got a minute or two here. If not, we'll just call it a day. right, hearing none, I want to thank everybody for participating in the call and being part of our call today. This is a regular series we do every third Tuesday of every month. We'll have another one in July. I'm not sure of the topic, but we'll sure to make the announcements well in advance. We have recorded the call, and we'll send you a link or send you an announcement if you want that, or just contact us if you're looking for that for any reason. So, again, thank you all for participating, and have a good afternoon. Bye, everybody.